Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In these programs, we present new information or new insights about old and new health issues. We consider everything from community efforts to improve and extend healthcare to all people, to environmental issues that threaten us all, and to discussions with those individuals and their ideas that can move us forward in the search for health. Last week, on October 10th and 11th, the Oregon Public Health Association had its 72nd meeting. It met this year in Corvallis, Oregon, on the OSU campus. And in this edition of the Health and Healthcare Forum, we'll be sampling from some of the talks and concepts that were floating around at those meetings. The keynote talk on Monday was given by George Luber, Chief of the Climate and Health Program at the National Center for Environmental Health at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He couldn't make it in person, but he sent a wonderful presentation that showed all his PowerPoints and his own face, and it was flawless, perfect, and there were questions and answers afterwards. Emily York heads up the Climate and Health Program here in the state, and she became kind of an interpreter for George Luber, talking about what he sent and what it means for Oregon. We'll be hearing from two new deans, a new dean of the OHSU-PSU School of Public Health, that's Dr. David Bangsberg, and Dr. Javier Nieto is the new dean of the OSU College of Public Health and Human Sciences. He starts at the end of this month. We'll have a short conversation with Jen Coleman with the Oregon Environmental Council. She'll tell us about an opportunity to intervene on behalf of keeping toxic substances out of children's products. Brian Johnson of the Lane County Department of Public Health will explain what public health modernization is all about and tell us what has happened in that process so far. On Tuesday, the keynoter was Helen Belanca. She has an MD and a Master of Public Health. She is the Associate Medical Director of the largest coordinated care organization in the state that serves about 250,000 people. Nurses are on the move too. Nancy Sullivan and Chris Tanner, both of whom have worked in nursing education at the Oregon Health Sciences University, will tell us about their initiative to involve nurses all over the state in working for universal health care. I'm Roberta Hall. I'm talking with Emily York. She has worked with our keynote speaker, who wasn't able to be here, but he sent a presentation. He actually gave it on air virtually. It was a wonderful presentation. His name is George Luger, and he's at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Emily, welcome to the program. Since we weren't able to talk to George, you weren't and I wasn't in person, and nobody here was able to talk to him actually in person, though there was some Q&A. I just thought it would be nice, since you work with the climate program here in Oregon, to ask you to summarize some of the points that he made, talk about why his work at the CDC is so important in Oregon.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity, Roberta. This is Emily York again. I coordinate the state of Oregon's climate and health programs in our Oregon Public Health Division. Yeah, I've had the chance to work with George. He is the director of the climate program at the CDC, so he's sort of our national thought leader when it comes to addressing climate change within our public health system. And so I think his talk today was really energizing. It covered a lot of the different ways in which climate change is connected to public health, and really did a great job of breaking down the current climate science in terms of the trends that we've observed over time, especially over the last century, in terms of temperatures and sea level rise and carbon concentrations in our air. And he brought all of that science that's being done at the global level down to pretty practical local examples of how it's affecting our health and how we can start to, as a public health system, adapt and change our systems and policies to protect our public health. It's a very, very complex topic. And as he's alluded to in his talk, it's still in many ways an emerging field. It was first started as a program at the CDC in just 2009. At that point, they were only able to fund 8 pilot programs, and the state of Oregon applied to participate as a pilot, and we were awarded that first early grant to start thinking about how we study and plan for the health effects of climate change here in Oregon. And so we were really lucky to have that early opportunity to learn along with several other counterparts across the nation. Since then, that has doubled to about 16 that they're now funding. And we heard that, you know, the intention is really that we would be able to do this kind of work in all 50 states. The grant funds basically my position. It's a very small grant, but it's enough to where we're starting to build our capacity within our public health department to integrate climate change considerations more into our public health practice and figure out, you know, what does that look like and how does climate change impact the work that we do across all programmatic areas of health. And I think that's one thing he spoke to today that really energized the audience, because no matter where we sit in our public health system, whether it's, you know, in public health emergency preparedness, or whether it's in communicable disease or chronic disease prevention, environmental health, which happens to be where my program sits, there are implications for all of us. There are ways in which the work we're doing is already building our community resilience. And so thinking about how public health can take the next step is, I think, what people walked out of the room really, really asking themselves is, how do I take the next step in the work that I do?
With this pilot approach, there also are several counties within the state that were particularly chosen. I don't know whether they applied to be in it or not, but Benton County, I believe, is one of them. That's where we are here.
That's right.
In Corvallis.
Yeah, exactly. So in that first pilot, when we were one of the 8 states to receive that early funding, we passed through most of that to 5 local health departments. I wasn't there when it all started, but it was a competitive opportunity. And they each approached the work slightly differently based on the area of Oregon, where they are, their political climate, what was already occurring within their department and with their partner agencies. And so each of them developed their own local climate and health adaptation plan. And we learned a lot through that process and now have just completed that kind of planning process at the state level, where we were engaging not only with those 5 local health departments, but a number of other partners, both in local health, in nonprofit organizations, academia, other state agencies, to understand what our plan of action should be, what are the recommendations that we have for our entire public health system to take action. And so it's been a really fascinating experience, and one big shift that I observed as we moved forward in engaging partners and stakeholders is that we really shifted from what began as sort of this hazard-focused approach, where we were really trying to prioritize, okay, what are the worst climate hazards coming down the pike, and which one should we prioritize? Is it wildfire? Is it drought? Is it heat waves? And then, you know, quickly as we were talking with our partners, we realized, wait, this isn't the right way to go about this planning process, because depending on where you are in our state, that priority is very different from one community to the next. And so really, the approach we need to take is a more strengths-based approach, a approach where we start with, what are our capabilities? Where do we add the most value? What do we do well as a public health system? And how do we use that to take climate action and to be more resilient and build community resilience through the services that we provide? And so it really was a great shifting in understanding, how do we even plan for this and identify strategies in the end that build resilience, hopefully, to multiple hazards, not just extreme heat or winter storms, but hopefully are really building the resilience of our systems to respond to a multitude of disruptions that could occur from climate change.
Oh, wow. You summarized that so well. I learned a lot. I've been to many climate presentations in our area and other places and read a great deal. But he focused on a few things that people normally don't. For instance, some of the hazards of carbon dioxide itself are not heat-related. That's something that people don't often think about, and maybe not wind-related. Now, mind you, I've noticed winds in this particular area. Winds are stronger, more frequent, more hours over this summer than they have been, and that may or may not be true of lots of other areas. And of course, we think of say Medford and Ashland area as really big on forest fires, but they could pop up somewhere else. and he emphasized that surprise is part of the package.
Right. There's so much uncertainty. That how do you plan for so many uncertainties?
It was really superb. Often the Oregon Public Health Association puts some of its main presentations, its PowerPoints, on its website.
There's a huge interest in this topic area, both among those of us in the public health workforce and just among the general public. I feel so privileged and also honored to be able to work on this and say this is part of my job, when really there are so many other people across Oregon from many different backgrounds and communities and areas of expertise that are interested in this topic, because it's about all of us. Like, it touches all of us. And so this new resilience plan that we're about to release in the next week is really the product of 2-year stakeholder engagement process, and over 50 people contributed to the content that's in this plan. And I think you might really like it because it has different videos and stories embedded within the plan that are really starting to make this kind of government planning more tangible, and hopefully something that's not just like up on a shelf, but that we can use to keep this dialogue going.
I should ask how that's going to be released. Will it be through the Oregon Health Authority?
Yeah, that's right. My program sits within the Oregon Health Authority, and so we'll be making it available online on our webpage at healthoregon.org/climatechange. And so everyone can find it there. It'll be on our main page for the next foreseeable future. And then we also have a listserv where we'll be shooting it out. And we do plan, I think, to have a press release and a number of other ways, hopefully through social media and other ways that people could find out about it.
Wow, that's wonderful. Well, it was excellent timing that the conference was just at this point, and he was involved, and you're here and involved. I was very impressed that he often, even in response to some questions, people ask questions such as, well, what do you think we should do? Well, he really believes that the CDC's role is to develop the science and the understanding and really all of that background, but it's for the states and the local communities to make the applications to the needs that they are aware of and that their population is interested in doing. That came up several times. It was very interesting, and obviously it's something he's thought about, and he's very concerned about the climate that social or policy climate that he's embedded in. He also doesn't think that we need to talk about climate change with our communities, as we don't need to use that terminology. It's not about denying or not denying, whatever that means. It's about recognizing situations that our communities might be in and ways to prevent the worst from happening, I think. Did you get that impression?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like you just summarized, they're able to do some of that really big kind of assessment and analysis of climate indicators and looking at the projections and what that might mean for the future of our health, and that there's not a one-size-fits-all solution, and it's really going to come down, like you just said, to the local communities understanding, you know, what might be the biggest priority. Because we know, for instance, he lives in Atlanta, and in the last week there's been a lot of attention on Hurricane Matthew. here in Oregon, we're not as concerned about hurricanes, but we have a huge amount of wildfires occurring, and that's projected to rise by 300% by 2050. And that means a lot more smoke in our air. And there's a number of other climate impacts we're looking at as well, and including bigger storms, which could result in heavier precipitation that causes flooding and displacement, perhaps, and a number of other things. And this is the thing, we can just start drawing all of these lines and connections between the way in which climate is impacting our weather, because climate is not our weather, but it's sort of the causes for why we're seeing more extreme weather events, and then the ways in which all of those extreme weather events can affect our health and our community. And yeah, I think he did a really great job of summarizing all of that science, but then also sort of encouraging us to take actions, being vocal in our communities and raising attention to the fact that what we're talking about when we talk about climate change is not just the disappearance of polar bears in the North Pole, but really we're talking about the increase of asthma among our children and our next generation. We're talking about, you know, the impact to our food systems and the fact that we will have less access to healthy food. And these are not just problems for our environment, but they're problems for us, people, and our children. So he did a really great job of really making the case for why this is there's such a huge role that public health can play.
Although he talked about some mental health problems, but he talked about the need to bring children into it in a positive way and involve them in things they can do. Doing something sometimes cures depression, in my observation as an old lady. No special insight here. I think everyone realizes that getting involved in a community effort is a lot more cheerful than looking at TV and being glum about it.
Yeah. Well, and there's so many pieces of the puzzle, right? So when we're only working on one piece of it, it's hard to think that we have an impact or that it matters. But if we work on that piece of the puzzle that we can work on and everyone else is working on their piece of the puzzle, we really can have an impact.
We can have an impact and look forward to a future that is worthwhile. Well, thank you very much, Emily York. It's October 10th, and the Oregon Public Health Association is meeting, just had its first session. Introduced were two new people who are going to be contributing a lot to public health, and they are two deans. We have them here for just a few minutes to tell a little bit about their backgrounds and what they hope to do when they're here. David Banksberg, you're at OHSU, PSU, School of Public Health.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here. As of the last 2 weeks, I'm the dean of the OHSU, PSU, School of Public Health. My goal is to bring together the best of OHSU and PSU to create a new School of Public Health in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you. And Javier Nieto? He is here at Oregon State University, and that's where we're actually meeting. OPHA has met here for a number of years in the Alumni Center and LaSalle's Stewart Center. You've had a very interesting background, and you've been in Spain a great deal. You have some great ideas, I think, so welcome.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here, and thanks for the invitation. And I'm actually not quite yet the dean. I will be dean in 3 weeks from now, starting October 31st.
Right. I remember now that you mentioned that when introduced, and I hope that nothing happens in these 3 weeks that makes you say, I'm getting out of here. Because obviously it's very important to OSU and to Oregon that the two of you be here and develop this program. Now, we just heard a keynote address, unfortunately virtually, from Georgia. It was finances that prevented that speaker from actually joining us. The whole country has some real problems to face in public health. The speaker who talked to us, George Luber, who's the chief of the Climate and Health Program, I noticed, particularly at the end, he emphasized it's what happens at the state and in the local communities that make the real difference, will make the real difference if we respond well to climate change in terms of public health measures. Would you just give your thoughts about that, Javier?
Well, I think the problem of climate change and the health consequences of climate change really is a good illustration of how important it is to consider our discipline broad so that all, it's not just about health sciences and traditional public health sciences, but also the need to involve all the, basically all the sectors in society to try to deal with this problem. Is economics, of course, is politics, is environment, is agriculture, is nutritional sciences, is everything. And I think that's is an important challenge that we in the public health community need to address with that very broad perspective to understand and try to alleviate the consequences for the health of the population derived from this crisis that we are facing.
One of the many roles you've had, we were told in the introduction, is that of an epidemiologist. It seems to me that relates very much to understanding the trends in the whole population.
My scientific career, so to speak, was in epidemiology, specifically cardiovascular disease and chronic diseases and sleep disorders. But that was after an earlier career, part of my career, where I was involved in primary health care and community health and public health and from a broader perspective. This is my new job here. I see it as going back a little bit as a circling back to my earlier career after my more research-oriented phase as an epidemiologist, trying to understand the causes of diseases. And now is more trying to bring that understanding to try to solve the problems of the health of the community.
As an administrator, you'll be integrating the work of a lot of people or
trying to build bridges with other scientists or other disciplines and other colleges and other departments that have not traditionally been seen themselves as involved in public health mission. But last night, David and I were talking about this very issue, how the traditional public health narrow approach of considering health sciences and nothing else is... It's not going to work to address the complex public health challenges that we face today, being climate change, obesity, epidemic, mental health issues at the community level. We need to involve every sector in society.
And now, Dr. Banksberg, you're a MD, and you've been in practice. How do you see the difference between providing health care for all, universal health care, and public health and how they can work better? Is having a real universal health coverage going to help public health concentrate on other things, or how are they going to integrate?
I became interested in public health when I was in medical school at Johns Hopkins Hospital in East Baltimore and saw the impact of health disparities caused by inadequate access to care, drug use, mental illness, structural violence and racism, and to see people suffer or benefit in such a dramatic way, block by block, I thought was a true injustice, and dropped my interest in basic neuroscience in order to pursue a career in public health, first focusing on HIV domestically and then in Africa. But what we see in the hospital is really the downstream consequences of inadequate efforts to both provide prevention of disease, to promote wellness, and to prevent the complications of disease. And now we have an opportunity to really think about health in a much broader lens, as Javier mentions. And I think Oregon has been a leader in healthcare reform with the Oregon Healthcare Act. And now with the CCOs, there's a real opportunity to think about what we can do at the population level. So we're not just looking at health through the lens of a hospital, at the end stream consequences of the inadequate prevention, inadequate promotion of health and well-being. And I think it's a very exciting time for Oregon. We look very much forward to contributing to discussions in Oregon to promote health and wellness at the population level.
Thank you. Dr. Nieto, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I agree 100% with what David said. As he said, a great opportunity, I'd say, because healthcare, we hope it moves in a direction that promotes more the finances and a reimbursement system that is based on keeping the population healthy rather than on the procedures or the interventions that clinicians do on their patients. And that will require a partnership between healthcare and public health. We in public health can contribute to the mission of the healthcare providers by bringing the context in which patients that go to hospitals and diabetics that are treated by healthcare providers and are given treatments and recommendations to be healthy, to do physical exercise, to have a healthier nutritional habits, etc., etc., but live in a context, in a neighborhood or in a rural town where they don't have access to those healthier options. I think we in public health, and by partnering with healthcare providers and healthcare organizations, can help in mapping those resources and providing physicians the tools to make more targeted prescriptions of healthy lifestyles for their patients. And that's a collaboration that hasn't existed that much in the past. And I think the current healthcare reform process will create an opportunity for that to happen.
And it's not over yet, right?
It's just beginning. We have a long ways to go.
Ah, very good. Well, you both are very busy today, I know. Thank you for taking the time. I'm very happy that you joined us here at KABU.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to a program from the Oregon Public Health Association's 72nd meeting, October 10th and 11th, 2016. We're at the Oregon Public Health Association, the first afternoon, Monday, October 10th. I'm talking with Jen Coleman of the Oregon Environmental Council about toxics and a particular law in Oregon. So, Jen, welcome, and tell us about the law and what it entails.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be talking about this law, something that was passed in Oregon in 2015. It's the Toxic Free Kids Act. And it's one of the strongest laws in the nation looking at toxics that occur in children's products, the exposure that kids get to chemicals that can affect their developmental health, can affect their lifelong health, that might occur in these children's products.
So it could be clothes or toys or anything of that sort?
Exactly. Clothes or toys or, you know, soothing products for infants. Any product that is made specifically for children is covered by this law. There's some exceptions, but for the most part, what Oregon Health Authority is going to look at is, you know, when these products are sold in Oregon, if these chemicals occur, and it may be any of 66 different chemicals, they have to report, the manufacturers have to report. So for the first time, we'll get a really good inventory of the kinds of exposures that might happen in everyday life for a little kid.
These could be made in New York State or in Taiwan or wherever. Is that correct?
That's right. And it's a law that is modeled after Washington State. Washington State was the first to start doing this kind of inventory. Oregon takes it a step further. So we not only get this inventory, but then after a certain period of time, the manufacturers have to either replace that chemical with something that is proven to be safer or eliminate it altogether.
Wow, that's really important.
Yes, it's very exciting. It's very exciting. And it's, you know, even as the law changes on a federal level, this kind of state law can have huge ripple effects all the way through the economy. You know, we've seen it happen in Washington just when they had to report that they're using these chemicals, you started to see manufacturers reformulate so that they wouldn't have to report. So if we have that added impetus to say you need to start looking for safer alternatives, just getting a process in place to look at safer alternatives is a huge change in the way people do business.
So because we were second to Washington a little bit later, it really helped in a sense. And of course, Washington has a larger population.
Yeah. And I think what happens is that, you know, Washington sort of made it possible. You can see that this inventory works, that it made it possible for Oregon to go a little bit further. But we're going to have a law that means that anybody, no matter where it's manufactured, if they sell in Oregon, they have to find safer alternatives. And that's going to have worldwide effects.
And the research Might be very interesting, too.
Exactly. And we're also looking at, on the federal level, they've done some reform of the big overarching chemical control law called the Toxic Chemicals Control Act, Toxic Substances Control Act. And this will inform the way that that law goes forward as well. Now, here's the opportunity. This law is, it took 5 years to put it in place. It took a long slog of a lot of negotiation and a lot of rhetoric, and we finally got that law in place. The next step is rulemaking. So Oregon has to figure out how they're going to put rules in place that manufacturers can follow so that they actually start receiving that information. And that process of rulemaking is a stakeholder process. So you have manufacturers and trade associations, national trade associations, coming to the table trying to influence the way that this law goes forward. And then you have one advocacy organization at that table as well.
One advocacy. And is that the Oregon Environmental Council?
And it is the Oregon Environmental Council. So what we're looking at now is looking for support from Oregonians and from health professionals and from everyone who cares about this law to come out and support the way that these rules are made. So that's why I'm here today, is to see if I can get some of these public health folks to come out and testify in favor of the way that these laws are constructed.
How can someone learn what the process is at this point that they might be able to support? Where is their website?
Yes. So Oregon Environmental Council, oeconline.org, has more information about this if you sign up for the Action Network. And the opportunity that's coming up is October 18th in Portland. There's going to be an open hearing for the public to come in and say what they think about the way these rules are drafted. And the reason we need people to come out, like, even if you don't know anything about the issue, if you just care about children's health and children's exposure, we need people in the room to support these strong rules, because you know that there are going to be paid trade associations in there as well, looking for ways to punch holes in it and create loopholes.
Right. And you don't want people to say, this can't be done.
Exactly.
Or if they do, to have a counter.
And the Oregon Health Authority has done a really good job of drafting rules that are going to work, but they need to be able to have a backstop of public support saying, good idea, protect these kids and be strong about it.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon at the OPHA.
My pleasure. So glad to see you here.
Glad to see you. My guest is Brian Johnson. He's with Lane County Public Health, and he mainly does epidemiology, if I'm remembering right.
That's correct, yep.
He was the president a few years back. But today we're talking about public health modernization, and I'd like him to explain a little bit about it.
Well, let me give it a try. I really think of public health modernization as expanding upon what we already do and growing our ability to be more responsive to the new age of what it means to do public health. For example, our ability to better handle emergencies and new and emerging illnesses such as Zika, or a few years back, H1N1. It's really building the capacity of our public health system to be more responsive and able to deal with these new threats that really didn't exist in the same way in years before.
Yesterday, we heard a lot about the public health impacts of climate change, and that may be one of them.
Exactly. Climate change is a good example of something we've started to better understand and realize that there are serious public health implications. Our system isn't necessarily set up to easily respond to those sorts of things without a greater investment, really, in getting the right training and the right folks in there who have a better understanding and ability to think about and provide science and provide sound evidence in our ability to respond.
Well, just for example, what if Zika showed up in a patient or two in Lane County?
Certainly, we would be responding now, and we've got trained nurses and staff that already follow up on any type of infectious disease investigation. The difference might be that we would have greater capacity to actively monitor or to pick things up a little earlier in the process before they've really expanded and show up in our community at a high numbers. You know, often it's a real struggle to stay ahead of the game, and I think that's what it would do. You know, our ability to work with labs and lab systems more effectively, our ability to actually collect data and information more effectively from our healthcare partners, all of those things would help us to have a better handle and stay ahead of the game instead of what we often struggle with now, is to be ahead of the game, but also to sometimes we're just having to respond as soon as something comes up, as opposed to taking care of it before it really becomes an issue. So, and I think the challenge is we don't often invest enough in the system to make sure that we can do that effectively.
You just a minute ago said the word partners. Is developing more partners part of this change?
And that's a new thing. But when you think about modernization of public health, part of that is really investing in our ability to collaborate and our ability to partner. It's really bringing in and having that staff and expertise that can really build those partnerships and grow them effectively.
Would they be, for instance, with the school district?
Absolutely. School districts, you know, a lot of times we think about transportation and its effects on health. So partnering with our transportation partners, our housing partners, food systems, those sorts of things that really have impacts on our health that we didn't often think about in the past and or put enough energy into. And if we can do that more effectively, certainly we can deal better with things like chronic diseases, which will continue to be an ongoing challenge for us and probably still the leading cause of death.
Diabetes,
heart disease, you know, cancers, those sorts of things.
The legislative part of this, though, maybe we could just talk 1 minute about that.
Sure. So what's happened so far is the legislation set the stage for an investment in understanding where our current health system is and then putting forth a recommendation. So that legislation set the stage for what the current recommendations that are moving forward as what we're thinking of as the modernization of public health in Oregon. So the next stage really is to think about, are we going to act upon those particular recommendations? Are we going to invest at the levels that are potentially identified to make that happen? Are there other sorts of things we might put in place, such as powers or abilities for the local public health to more effectively do their work? Those are the sorts of steps that would be in consideration next. But right now, what's currently in place was really just that investment in where are we now, where do we want to be, and what's it going to take to get there. So,
okay. So now there's sort of a plan.
I mean, what's nice about that is it was guided by an advisory group that was from folks from many, many different sectors, not just public health, but health systems and elected officials and others who came to these conclusions as to where we are now and what do we want to do about it. So,
well, thank you. That helps a great deal. So that is a partnership in itself in
exactly.
The planning process. Well, good luck with it.
Well, thank you. Good luck for all of us. I think it has the potential to really improve our livability in Oregon by investing in our health system. So,
very good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
My guest is Helen Belanca. She is an associate director of HealthShare, which is a CCO, coordinated care organization in the Portland area and several counties.
I'm the associate medical director, and we work in Multnomah County, Washington County, and Clackamas County.
Well, welcome to the program. We're just doing a little conversation about her keynote speech at the OPHA on Tuesday, October 11. It was a great talk, and so we're just recapping a little bit of it.
Thanks.
The title is quite interesting. I'll let you give it.
The title was Sandwiches to Space Shuttles, and I use that reference. It's from a Calvin and Hobbes comic. Calvin and Hobbes are talking about what they would wish for if they could wish for anything in the world. Hobbes wishes for a sandwich, and Calvin wishes for his own private continent and $1 trillion and his own space shuttle. And then when they're back later at the house, we see Hobbes happily eating his sandwich and saying, well, I got my wish. And the idea is that we could wish for simple, practical things like a sandwich that we know that we can get, or we can think about wishing for something much bigger, much more aspirational, like a space shuttle, which is a much bigger vision and much more complicated, but will also sort of get us closer to the vision of an integrated health system that we're all interested in having.
And so ultimately, you say you need both. You need both kinds of people and ideas working in a system because it's really good to achieve something at the end of a day.
Yeah. I don't think it's the case that it either has to be achievable or aspirational. I think you can have both, that it's somewhat of a false dichotomy in that as we build achievable goals and plans in our work, we could make sure that they are also aspirational and think about how our roles should change in the community and how our partnerships should change so that we can get closer to an ideal vision.
And I should say about Helen, she has an MD degree. She's a family physician and is practiced. She also has an MPH, a Master of Public Health. And that was because she found that in practicing medicine, you're dealing with individuals and they're all sick. And a bigger vision and a community vision is useful too. Am I summarizing that okay?
That's right. Yeah, it's that idea that the healthcare system is really oriented toward illness and the public health community has an orientation toward health. And I think the healthcare system can learn a lot from the public health community in building a system that is more oriented toward health and advancing health rather than just treating illness.
So I like the way she talked about the coordinated care organizations, which is a unique term, I think, to Oregon, but something similar to it is being talked about nationally. It's a different way to deliver health care, but the way I interpreted what she said, it's organizing health care delivery within the principles of public health. So you put those two together. She gave such interesting examples of how the two work together. I'd like her to just mention one or two.
Yes, so you're right. The model is unique to Oregon, but it's very similar to in other states and elsewhere in the country where they're doing accountable care organizations. And accountable care organizations just means that we need to think about the quality of care that we deliver and be accountable for that quality as we deliver it. And that's certainly a feature of CCOs, but CCOs go beyond that and say that in order to best address people's healthcare needs, we need to integrate physical health care with mental health care and with dental health care, substance use disorder treatment, and the community supports that people need in order to achieve optimal health. So it's a much bigger vision than just accountable care. And so the examples that I talked about are places where CCOs have partnered with our public health departments locally, with our state public health department, with our counties, with community organizations, community serving organizations to advance that. And the one area, one example of that would be our family well-being assessment. This is a questionnaire that was developed by a committee of the Oregon Perinatal Collaborative, and it was really designed for women entering prenatal care. It's really a clinical tool to use in clinics where women are receiving prenatal care, and it screens them for mental health concerns, substance use disorders, domestic violence, and basic resource needs like housing and food and childcare. At the end of the assessment, there are a number of strategies for how to connect pregnant women with the resources they might need to optimize their health during pregnancy. Maybe they need a behavioral health clinician that's already in place at the clinic. Maybe they need a home visiting program that's run through the county. Maybe they need maternity case management, or maybe they need to be connected with a community organization that can help them with rent assistance or with food insecurity issues. And so it's, in a way, it's teaching the healthcare system how to connect with the broader system of care and supports that are available for families in our communities. And it's teaching those systems, the public health systems and the community systems, about how to better communicate with the healthcare. So, because we're all part of the same team, we're all caring for the same families. And so it's a really great example of how we can build partnerships across sectors in order to optimize people's health.
And that has been somewhat lacking. As many people have pointed out, many people have talked about the disparity in payment that in this country, we put $3 trillion into patient care, direct patient care, and as far as public health, what is the...
$80 billion compared to $3 trillion.
$80 billion compared to $3 trillion. And it's been said by past leader of a Medicaid Medicare services, Don Berwick, who talked on August 1, that of the $3 trillion, about a third is wasted. That was his sad comment. He said, as he's learned more over the years, he wishes there were things that he didn't know, but he has to know them and wants to make those changes. And organizing patient services in a more coordinated fashion, Oregon thought, would help to address that very issue. So that was the topic of the talk today, and there were many excellent questions. One rather strange one, I thought, maybe you didn't think it was strange. It was a question about whether these coordinated care organizations have changed the way care is delivered for other sectors of the population, other sectors than those who are enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. The reason I thought it was strange was that, hey, they're not affected. It only serves one quarter of the population, that quarter of the population that is enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan.
That's true. Right now, the coordinated care experiment, coordinated care organizations, are really limited to the Medicaid population. But there's been a lot of talk in our state about the coordinated care model and how the principles of coordinated care should apply across all sectors, that commercially insured people and people with Medicare or other types of insurance, really the principles and the models can be transferred. Basically, you know, they look, use a population health perspective, make sure people have the care management services they need, make sure the systems are accountable for quality and patient satisfaction, make sure there's broad access. So while CCOs right now only cover the Medicaid population, there's a lot to learn from the model that can be applied elsewhere.
And the question is, can the structures be massaged or manipulated or rethought in order to accommodate that? Perhaps that's the big challenge of our time.
Yes, it is. I agree.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Roberta. I really appreciate you taking the time to have me on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. My guests are two nurses, Nancy Sullivan and Chris Tanner. They're working on a particular project within nursing, but first let's welcome them, Nancy and Chris.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Yes, happy to be here as well, talking to you about the movement for single-payer health care and for the role that nurses are going to be playing in that effort in Oregon.
Well, nurses have a great reputation in general, and of course there are all kinds of nurses and all kinds of nursing. Tell me about what your backgrounds are in terms of nursing experience and why you were attracted to this particular topic.
Well, I went to nursing school in New York in the late 70s because I had lived in France for 5 years. I was married and had a baby in France, and I had a midwife there, and they had a wonderful healthcare system where you just got health care. You didn't ever worry about payment. I came back to the States and went to nursing school so that I could go to a graduate school in midwifery, which I did at Columbia University. And in 1985, we moved to Oregon, and I got a job at Oregon Health and Sciences University teaching in the nurse midwifery program, which I did for about 20 years. And then I worked at Providence for a while as a nurse midwife and doing some other clinical work before I retired.
Okay, Nancy. How about you, Chris?
I have been a nurse since 1969. I went to nursing school in Colorado. Spent the first 4 years of my career mostly working in hospitals and intensive care units, and then went into academics and spent most of my career at Oregon Health and Science University, with my last position there being the dean of the School of Nursing, the interim dean. And I retired from that position 2 years ago. During my time at OHSU, I worked with nurses all over the state to do major reform of nursing education. And I saw the power of nurses working together. Nurses who really believe that, as we put it, that Oregon's health depended on nurses being well-prepared, well-educated, and serving as advocates for their patients. This kind of close working relationship with nurses in every town that has a community college or an OHSU campus really gave me great faith in nurses' ability to lead social change, which is what our educational project was. When I retired from that work, several of my colleagues and I vowed to now take on healthcare, since we could reform nursing education. And so, you know, we all witness every day the impact of our crazy financing system, of people losing homes and, you know, their resources because of medical bankruptcy, people putting off care because they can't afford it, people not taking medications because they've gotten outrageously expensive. Really, we can't provide better care until we can figure out a more sane financing system. And so when I retired, I took a little while to figure out what I wanted to do with my retired time. And I got on a single-payer comprehensive universal health plan for people over 65 called Medicare. And I think everybody ought to have it.
Oh, that's an interesting way to put it. And it sounds like between the two of you, you've, as we used to say, slain one dragon at a time.
Well, we're working on it.
Well, this is a big one.
Yes.
It's a very big one.
Very
complex.
Yeah. So are you working within the Oregon Nurses Association, separate groups?
We have a core group.
Yes.
Of nurses that actually started this movement before we came on, who are affiliated, most of the nurses, with the Oregon Nurses Association. But it's not come up yet as a major policy agenda for the Oregon Nurses Association, though we're hoping to change that.
My goodness. I think California nurses have done that. Am I wrong about
that? That's right. Yeah, and the New York State Nurses Association have been extremely successful through their work in continuing education of nurses throughout the state, that the House, New York House, has passed a single-payer bill. It's not passed the Senate yet. Mm-hmm. But nurses have really single-handedly led that, is our understanding in New York. And there's also the National Nurses Union.
National Nurses United is the largest nursing union in the United States, and really big in California. They have 185,000 members, and health care for all is very high on their agenda. So they are working in California and in other states where they are a prominent player to promote single-payer health care.
And in Oregon, I remember reading your abstract. I think I'm remembering 55,000 nurses. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yes. So we want to somehow reach all 55,000 of those nurses, but we're really trying to focus on maybe 10,000 who we can reach through education and information sessions in nursing schools and other venues, and get them to agree to go out as ambassadors for single-payer healthcare themselves in their communities, get their patients, their colleagues and others, neighbors, everyone. They're nurses in every corner of Oregon, in every community, large and small, and I think they are the perfect ones to do this, particularly as you said, Bobby, they are highly respected by people. We always come out as the most highly respected profession. Everyone knows a nurse in their community, so we're thinking nurses can really play a major role in this.
Do you think that some of the employers of these nurses will push back, or how will that work? Have you thought about that issue?
One advantage of working through universities, you know, there's a little bit more flexibility, I think, in nurses being able to take, and faculty being able to take positions without danger of job loss. So I think that people have the right to speak out for their beliefs and what they believe is right, and I think there will be some who will be fearful of that. And I think part of our work with them will have to be, how do you work that through and, you know, make it so we can be safe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting.
You know, I think it's a fear of retribution, but also a fear if we actually change financing, would be economic reasons for job loss. And I think both of those are concerns that won't be asked in our conversations.
Oh, I should ask one other question that just occurred to me. When you say nurses, are you speaking of RNs or other, you know, there are various types of nurses,
right?
There are.
I'm
a nurse practitioner legally in the state of Oregon. Nurse midwives are a class of nurse practitioner. So I'm a nurse practitioner. In order to be in that category, you have to have a master's degree and in a specific field, and then you can work as a nurse practitioner. I think we welcome all nurses. The Oregon Nurses Association has a number of subcategories of nurses that they represent.
In terms of your outreach, it's nurses, period.
Nurses.
It, period.
Yeah. Period,
right.
Yes.
Right. Our focus, the 55,000 number represents the registered nurses. And of course, there are nurse practitioners, about 3,000 or so, I think. Mm-hmm. And licensed vocational or practical nurses, maybe 1,500 to 2,000. Mm-hmm. State, I'm not sure of the numbers there. But.
Interesting. I'm going to tell you a secret about my own background. From 64 to 66, I was a librarian at a hospital school of nursing.
Oh.
One of the last. And in our library, of course, a lot of the literature concerned the changeover because they all knew it was coming.
Yes.
And we're
exactly
working on it. So it's just kind of interesting. This was
evolution.
In Illinois. So you're going through the educational system as much as you possibly can.
Right.
Education of nurses.
Right.
And so working with instructors, perhaps deans or, you know, the leaders.
Right. Mm-hmm. And also we're connected with their communities and with nurses in the community.
So, for instance, there's a program here at Lynn Benton Community College in nursing. So it might be, its leadership might be approached, can we give a seminar? Or can we,
exactly.
Is that the,
exactly.
that the
yes.
type
right.
of, and of course we need to say that we're right now at the Oregon Public Health Association, and you're giving a talk very, very soon this afternoon, Monday, October 10th.
And yes. On Thursday, we're going to Hood River to give a talk to the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon.
Wonderful. Right. And they're having a general meeting.
Yes, yeah. It's their annual conference, so we're speaking at that as well.
Those are the places. Well,
and then in Monmouth in November to the senior students at Oregon Health and Science University campus in Monmouth, Oregon, in their health policy class.
So would you mind giving your email address or a website that anyone who was involved in education could reach you?
So yeah. nursesforsinglepayer.org.
Yes.
nursesforsinglepayer.org is right. The way if someone wanted to more information or to request.
And just call right to info@nursesforsinglepayer.org.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, Chris and Nancy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this.
The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers and Kent White.